Welcome our friend and speaker, Lorenzo from Bakersfield.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Bill, for inviting me. He invited me probably about 5 months ago, maybe more or less. But I've been thinking about this day ever since then. I've been not preparing for it, but I didn't prepare for it until just a few hours ago. But again, we're new in the area, getting to know some of the meetings and stuff. And the very first thing I did when I came to Visalia was look up an AA meeting. I knew that I didn't know anybody. I knew that before I looked for a church, before I looked for a job, before I looked for anything else, I had to find an AA meeting. Because if not, I don't know what could happen. I could be drinking again. I don't know. But I think that there's power in numbers, there's power in fellowship, there's safety in numbers. And I knew if I was going to be safe, I had to find an AA meeting ASAP. So if you guys are ever going to move to a new city, I would give you this advice. Find an AA meeting. Priority. Make that a priority. Would you all agree that alcoholics are extreme people? Did you drink extremely? I not only drank. Part of my story is the other things, too. So when I drank, nothing. There was no such thing as a bad idea. When I drank, I smoked. When I smoked, I snorted. When I snorted, I smoked some more. Other stuff. And after that, I went out to the streets looking for any kind of company that I could find. If I had to buy it, I bought it or anything. I just did not want to be alone, did not want to be scared. And as a young boy, fear was my number one enemy. When my mom and I would drive to the store, I would have so much anxiety that I would start to get the dry heaves. I would throw up. And, you know, they didn't know how to explain it to my Mexican mom. She goes, oh, he's a worrywart. And so right away, I was labeled, I'm a worrywart. I worry about everything. I'm scared of everything. I throw up because I don't want to do this. I didn't want to go to school because I was afraid. And growing up in my family, we were your typical Hispanic family. We had relatives in Wasco. We had relatives everywhere. And every time we got together with the relatives, there was going to be beer. There was going to be food. There was going to be tequila. There was going to be weed. There was going to be a fight. There was going to be a loud argument. There was going to be one of my uncles or two sloppy, passed out drunk in the corner over here, or one sobbing and crying and I love you and everything else, you know. So that was my upbringing. I remember my first sips of beer were I must have been 7, 8 years old. My dad had this little Mercury Cougar. I think it was a 70, I don't know, it might have been a 60s, little short Cougar. And I used to stand up on the seat and ride with my arm around my dad. There were no seat belts back then, or if there was, nobody used them. And I'd ride with my dad like this, and he'd snap his fingers. And my job was to reach over to the paper bag, get out the beer, pop the top, and give it to him, the full one. He'd give me the empty one, and I'd wait for the next road sign to come. He'd be like, you ready? And he'd pull over to the roadside, fling it out, and hit the sign. If I was accurate, I would hit the sign with the bottle, yes. And then if I hit the sign, he would give me a sip. And it was good. It was like nice, cold, wonderful. And my first drunk, I was about 11. And me and my buddies were cleaning out his grandma's garage. And I didn't know that in one of the boxes we found a bottle with a man wearing, I think he was holding bagpipes and wearing a kilt. And I found out later, I think it was Beefeater Gin. And we said, hey, we could drink this. Grandma doesn't know. Go get some Kool-Aid. One of you go get some Kool-Aid, and they'll think we're drinking Kool-Aid. So that was my first real drunk. And I was, all I could remember, the sun was brighter. The grass was greener. I had no fear. I had confidence. I could do anything. Last thing I remember was dancing in the yard, in the grass, and everything was beautiful. Everything was perfect. Everything was warm. Everything was just the way it should be, I guess. The very next memory I remember was the next morning. My friend's mother threw me in the shower, turn on the cold water, washing vomit off of myself. I didn't do it. She was washing it off of me. I was naked and unashamed. And the very next thing I wanted to do was do it again. I said, this is it. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. That was the best thing that had ever happened to me at that time. And from that point on, I think that's when the alcoholism kicked in, because I told my buddies, I said, hey, your mom and dad have a little room next to the kitchen full of that stuff, don't they? Well, let's get some. And my mission for the rest of my youth was to, okay, if I got a friend that's dad had beer, we were going to get the beer. If I had a friend who somebody had a bar in the house, we were going to get the alcohol. If there was a party going on, a keg party down the street, we were going to sneak in and get what we can, fill up a milk jug or whatever when nobody was looking. And back then I knew that the adults had to have seen us, because we weren't that slick. But we were getting it, and we were getting drunk. What I couldn't figure out was, after a night of drinking, or a day of drinking, or whenever we were drinking, that after I'd gotten thrown up or sick at least once or twice, my friends wanted to stop. They didn't want to do it anymore. And I couldn't understand why they would want to stop doing something so great. And after that, I thought, you know what? I gotta find me some new friends. These guys, you know, they don't get it. They don't understand they just didn't feel it like I did. They wanted to go to school the next day. They didn't want to get in trouble. They figured out that there was a pattern going on, getting in trouble with our parents, getting in trouble for stealing Uncle Cecil's VO out of his welding truck, and, you know, lying about it. So I had to find some new friends. And I was probably about 15 or so, looking for some new friends. And I found some new friends with some new habits, new things to do, new mixtures, new combinations. You guys know what I mean. And that opened up so many doors for me. And it took me down so many scary alleys and so many places. So the fun of it had already begun to turn into a dangerous place. It began to turn into a scary place, because once I started mixing other things in with the alcohol, it started getting crazy. I started to see a part of me that was dangerous and that was hurtful. By 15, I had broken my grandmother's wrist, forcing her to write a check for me so I could go party, so I could buy a little bag to carry in my pocket and go drink with the rest of the guys and smoke. And I not only broke that, I broke her heart a million times by stealing and lying and abuse. It was just abuse, you guys. So about that time, I was too much for her to handle. Grandpa had passed away, and the only person that would take me in was my dad, who had by this time gotten sober And the very first thing he told me, when you come to live with me, we have rules in the house. And the rules are, we don't drink, we don't use drugs, we go to church on Sunday, and we read the Bible. Well, I was like, wow, I could do that. I didn't have nowhere else to go. So I figured I'd follow the rules. But this is my story is a spiritual story. This is a spiritual program. So there will be some spiritual mentions here. I did stay with my dad, and I did go to church, and I followed the rules for about 3 years. And I had an experience with God at church. Mm-hmm. And about 2 years after that, I started running in. I'm about 18 now. I started running into the old kind of characters, you know. We started drinking. We started using again. I'd always had real good jobs. I was always fortunate to be able to land the good jobs, but never smart enough to be able to keep them. And all the jobs that I ended up getting were jobs that were really, really close to alcohol. And it was really easy for me to access at a young age as much as I needed and as much as for anybody else to make friends. If I could give you some alcohol, I could buy your friendship. I could try to buy your friendship. And those weren't really the kind of friends that I needed at the time. By 20 years old, by 25 years old, I think, I had two kids. I'd gotten married and had two beautiful kids. But my using and my drinking, I don't want to say had stolen their childhood, or me stole their childhood from me, because I didn't experience their childhood. I pretty much gave it away, because I would rather be working to make money to buy drugs and alcohol than going home and staying with my kids and enjoying my kids and enjoying my wife. So I lost my kids, I lost my wife, I lost their youth. We have a good relationship now, but I lost all those years of, I never played ball with my son. Every time he would come to me to play ball, hey, Dad, let's go play. I'd be with the guys watching the football game. I said, no, we'll do it later. Or, hey, my daughter would come, hey, Dad, can you help me with homework? I'd be with my friends partying somewhere. No, you know, I'll do it later. So I wouldn't say that we get those things stolen from us. I think we have a choice in giving it away, and I freely gave it away. And always in the back of my mind, I always heard a voice saying, go home. What are you doing here? Do you need to be out every day of the week? Go home. There's people who need you, people who love you at home. But I never went. By this time, I'm about 30 years old. My kids, I'm divorced. My kids are living with my wife, who is actively using, my ex-wife by this time. She's actively using. When I go to get my kids, I'm trying to make a relationship with my kids. When I go to try to pick them up, I'd always promise them, hey, this weekend we're going to the fair. This weekend we're going to go see the new movie that's coming out. Back then it was probably Aladdin, the cartoon. And this weekend, you know, we're going to go fishing. The fishing trips would only last until the beer ran out. A lot of times, by the time I picked them up from Porterville and got home to Bakersfield, I was so drunk that I would just pass out, and Dad would sleep all weekend while the kids watched TV or were pretty much on their own. And it got to the point once they got older that they would just say, no, Dad, we got something else going on. We don't want to go with you. Because they knew I had a pattern. I had lied so much that they knew that the pattern was going to be the same. So about this time, the grandmother that I mentioned earlier, that I broke her wrists, she passed away, and she left me a pretty good inheritance. An inheritance for me and an inheritance that was in my name for my kids. And my alcoholism and other things began to escalate with the money that was coming in. I blew through mine. It went up my nose. It went in my gut and drinking, going to bars, making friends who weren't really friends, buying everybody drinks. And once my inheritance ran out, I proceeded to spend my kids' inheritance. And now that I think about it, that was part of my amends, and I had to tell them that. And it was one of the hardest things, and it still is one of the hardest things to live with, because it was a college education. Who knows? Who knows what they could have done with that? So down the road, I'm in my mid-30s. I've got 2 DUIs. I'm still able to work 2 jobs. And I'm still panhandling out in front of the liquor store just to get another beer because I've spent all my money throughout the week. I got a line of credit from the guy that owns the store on the corner. So every check I get goes straight to him, and then the cycle begins again. And I have to go to another store to try to panhandle while I'm working 2 jobs just to get enough money to get the shakes off or drive the car. I didn't feel comfortable. I'm still driving with no license. I know who's done that in here. Yeah. No. If a cop got behind me, I'd pull in front of somebody's house, even if I didn't live there, and pretend I lived there, just to get that cop out from behind me. So, by this time, I'm driving with no license. I've got 2 DUIs. It took me 6 years to get those 2 DUIs off of my record because I couldn't go to the steps. I don't know if you guys have steps class here or whatever the DUI, the drunk driving school is. Well, I couldn't stay sober long enough to go to a DUI class. They kept kicking me out. Kept costing me more money to get back into the class. They kept kicking me out. It cost more money until finally they said, don't come back. You're not getting your license. Mid-30s, I was weighing about 300 pounds. Every time I poked my calves with my finger or any part of my body, any fat part of my body, which was, it was all just, I was so bloated, you guys, that if I pushed in on my skin anywhere, it would stay. Until later, it was start to smooth out. It was just beer, I guess. Everything. That was my number one thing, King Cobra. I was sick all the time. Every morning, I would vomit up that yellow stuff, bile, every morning. And my son still tells me, my son's 26 now, and every now and then I'll brush my teeth, and, you know, you get the gag reflex going on, and he'll say, Dad, I remember you used to do that every morning. He goes, that's all I remember, was waking up to that every morning. He's 26 years old, and he still remembers that. I was miserable. I had met a guy in an AA meeting. There was a noon meeting I would go to because I knew I needed help. But I would go there, and they would love me, and I'd go back out, and I'd drink. So I was in and out, in and out. And they kept loving me, and they kept giving me numbers, and they kept saying, hey, man, you can make it. There's another meeting in another hour. You need to be at that meeting, because they knew as soon as I was done with that, I was going to go drink. There was a guy at this meeting that had approached me, and he said, hey, why don't you come to our recovery group? And I went to this church recovery group. I showed up very, very drunk, very stinky. I didn't know that. I thought that when they handed out mints, that they handed them to everybody in big scoops like this. They're like, here. They give them all. They're, eat them all. Eat them all. They're for you. Because I smelled so bad. And I didn't care about showering. I didn't care about anything but drinking. And this man asked if he could pray for me, and I said, yes, please, I need some help, I'm desperate. And he prayed that unless I stopped drinking, that I would be miserable, that I would vomit my guts out every time I thought about it, that I would be so fearful and so scared until I stopped. And he even prayed that, he just prayed, God, if he doesn't stop drinking, then just take him out of the picture. Take him. Because he's hurting everybody around him. He's hurting his kids, his mom, everybody. And I wanted to tell the guy, that's enough. Stop. You don't have to. No. Because I was really, really scared because this was going to come true. And it did. He also prayed that I would not have any satisfaction or any joy out of drinking. And I'd lost the joy years ago. But I did find satisfaction in drinking till I passed out or drinking and knowing that I got drunk. But I got to a point, you guys, where I could not get drunk anymore. And I think maybe that's a scientific thing, that is, once your tolerance is so high, I don't know. But I couldn't find any satisfaction in it, and I couldn't find any joy, and I could not get drunk anymore. So I started the combinations again. I started trying new things. I worked with a guy at a body shop that had a connection with needles, and I tried to get that. And to this day, I was in a band with a couple of gals. We were in a band that would play for beer wherever we went. And I had taken that rig over to her, and I asked her, would you please do this for me? Because I think this is the only way I can get high now. And she told me, you get your ass the hell out of my house right now, and don't you ever come back. You come over here with that crap again, I'm going to beat your ass. My brother's going to beat your ass. Get out of here right now. And to this day, when I see her on Facebook or when she's on my heart or something, I text her and I say, thank you. She goes, if you would have tried that, you would have liked it so much that you would never, ever come back. I know you. I know your addictive personality. You'd never come back. And I thank her to this day, because I wouldn't be here if she wasn't there to give me that tough, tough love. So what happened? It was Halloween, and I'm dating this gal, and she's a really nice girl, really fun, really young, really liked to party, and had money. So we were having a really good time, and we thought we were going to go to one of these Scream in the Dark horror kind of attraction. And it was really scary. It was really bloody. And I figured I was going to have a really good time that night. So on top of the King Cobra I drank from the time the store opened until we went out partying, I was going to top it off with some gin. And I think that was the last time I drank gin since the time in the first time. After the date was over, I could not get comfortable in my bed. I couldn't roll over. I couldn't lay on my stomach. I couldn't lay on my side. I was bloated out to here. And I thought, something's got to give, because this does not feel right. And fortunately, I still had a job with good insurance. So I thought, well, you know what? I'll go do what always works before. I'll go throw up in the sink, and everything will, you know, get back to normal. But I went to the sink, and it was one of these old double sinks, you know. And I threw up bright red blood. I filled up both sides of the sink. And it was the scariest thing I'd ever seen in my life. Because the more I'd throw up blood, the more I'd vomit. It was just going back and forth. And I thought, this could be bad. Yeah. I thought, okay, if I go to the hospital, they're going to make me stop drinking. I'm not going to be able to drink in the hospital. So I'm balancing this out. Stop drinking, or I could possibly bleed to death right here. I said, you know what I'll do? I'll call the advice nurse. And the advice nurse will tell me that, oh, you're okay, hopefully. Well, her advice was, Mr. Montesino, you need to get to a hospital right away before you die. So I called my mom, and I said, Mom, come pick me up. I need to go to the hospital. Take me to the hospital. Well, she called an ambulance. She gave the address of where I was to the ambulance. The ambulance came and picked me up. She followed me all the way to the hospital. Got in the emergency room. And mind you, I've been in and out of emergency rooms with anxiety, with vomiting, with all kinds of stuff. They know me there. And they knew I didn't want to get sober. So the nurse takes me back. She's a really nice-looking, red-headed nurse. I can see her right now. And she took me back there, and she goes, we're going to pump your stomach, Mr. Lorenzo. When this hose, which was probably about that big around, if you've ever had your stomach pumped, you'll know. She goes, we're going to run this hose up your nose. When it gets here to the gag reflex, whatever you do, don't gag, just swallow. And I'm like, I got this. So she's running it through my nose. It gets there. The very first thing I do when I feel it, I say, blah. And I throw up all over her beautiful white dress, all over her face, blood and bile and everything else. And she just looks at me with disgust, steps out of the curtain, puts the curtain back, and leaves. She shoved that thing down in my stomach first, and then started the machine and walked out. And I could hear her, and I could hear the doctor out there, and they're saying, it's him again. The doctor says, I've got people that want to live. This guy just keeps doing it again and again. I got other people to see. So I'm like, they're just going to leave me here. So I'm sitting there with my stomach's being pumped. And this is a classic. I don't know if you guys were into cartoons or anything, but it's the classic cartoon where the devil pops up on your shoulder and the angel pops up on your shoulder. Well, this was the devil. But it was the sweetest, smoothest, silkiest voice I'd ever heard in my life. And he said, just give up. Your mom has been following you in that ambulance, crying her eyes out. Your kids don't want to see you anymore. You pretty much killed your grandma and grandpa with stress. You've broken every promise. You've told every lie to everyone who loves you in your life. Just give up. And I did. I started giving up. And this, just like in the movies, you guys, fade to black. The circles started coming in right here, all the ways, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I was giving up. Then I heard another voice say, no, you don't you dare give up. We're not through with you yet. I'm not through with you yet. You're going to do great things. You fight for your life. Right now, you fight with everything you've got. Fight. Fight, Lorenzo. Fight for your life. So I started fighting. The lights came back on. I started fighting. I fought the nurses. I had emergency surgery. They had my esophagus was wore out. My liver had stopped pumping blood to my heart, so it was backing up into my stomach. And that's why I was bombing it out. So I had to have emergency surgery, and I'm fighting. I don't know who to fight, but all I know is just to fight, 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 fight for your life. These guys, I got like three orderlies holding me on my side. They got tubes going up this way, tubes going down this way, and I'm fighting them. And finally, I just remember passing out and waking up like 3 days later in a hospital room, and asking the first person that came to visit me, can you go get me a beer? Go get me a small bottle of vodka. You can sneak it in and nobody will know. Go get me some drink. I had to stay in the hospital for 10 days. Nobody brought me anything. What kind of friends is that, huh? Real friends. Yeah, thank you. So, 10 days later, as soon as I had some time to myself, I walked over to that store, bought me 4 40s of King Cobra, went to the backyard, and proceeded to drink again. The first one went down, and the next thing I could taste was blood coming back in my mouth again. And I knew. I said, I'm powerless. I can't do this. So I went out in the backyard, and I looked up to the sky, and I said, God, if you don't take this from me, I am going to drink myself to death. And the first idea that popped into my head, called Doug Allen from the AA meeting. And I called him. And he said, I'll be right over. And he picked me up and he took me to a meeting. And I committed to doing the work, like it said in the promises, painstakingly, no matter what, I was going to do this because I was going to die if I didn't. And Doug told me, you don't have to do it alone, man. He said, there's no Lone Ranger alcoholic anymore. You've got a team. These people are going to be your family. These people are going to love you till you can love yourself. And I stuck with it. I got a sponsor. I've had 3 sponsors. My first sponsor was a really, really tough love kind of sponsor. He let me go through my detox without anything. I kept asking him. There was a little pill that they used to give you that would take the edge off of the detox. And I said, give me some of those. He goes, no, I want you to remember every second of this. I want you to never, ever, ever forget what you're feeling right now, because you're not going to ever want to do it again, and you're not going to do it again. So I want you to feel all of this. I remember calling him, and I called him and cussed him out so many times. I called his wife. I cussed her out. She gave me a job after this. She gave me a job working with kids. I still work with kids. And I had another sponsor during that time who was a diabetic, and I watched what alcohol did to him through diabetes. It took his toes, took his foot, took his knees, both legs, and it finally took his life. I had another sponsor that was an atheist, and he taught me how to work the program, and I listened to him. He told me, never go to a meeting alone. He goes, dude, you still got a car? I said, yeah, it's one of the, I still got a car. It wasn't much of a car. He had to get in on the passenger side to open up the driver's side and go around. But he goes, good. He goes, I don't ever want to see you come to a meeting alone. He goes, you go to the homeless shelter and get somebody. You go to the recovery home and get somebody. You go somewhere, you call somebody. Never come to a meeting alone. And I did that probably for a few years. And then he told me, one of the other sponsors says, you need to get a coffee commitment. He goes, can you make coffee? I said, I don't know. Yeah, I guess. He goes, yeah, you can make coffee. He goes, you make coffee every Monday night at this meeting. That ensures that you go to a meeting. And then the atheist sponsor, he told me to work the steps. And he told me, don't be afraid of any of the steps, no matter what you hear. Because I always heard in the meetings, oh, I'm afraid to take the 7th step or the step to make amends. And I'm afraid to do the inventory. I'm afraid to do that. He said, don't be afraid to do that because you're going to be doing it the rest of your life over and over. You might do one step here today. You might work another step tomorrow. It's part of your life doing that. Don't be afraid of them. And I always heard him talking about amends. And I just want to tell you guys, when you make your amends, don't be afraid of anything. That's the one thing I was afraid of, making amends, because I had burned so many people and hurt so many people. But I had prepared myself to make the amends. I had some money. I had taken time to maybe work off whatever I could do to make up for the things I did, the things I stole. And the first guy I went to, I had stolen some tools from when I worked at the shop. I stole tools, cut through the fence, took tools, traded them for whatever. And I told him, I said, hey, Hal, I got about $300 here, and I know I stole those tools, and I just wanted to let you know that I'm the one that did it. He goes, I know you're the one that did it. And I said, well, this is all I got right here. I know it's worth more, but he goes, you know what, man? The best thing you can do to repay me is don't drink again. He goes, man, he goes, you're a good guy. You work hard. You knew what your job was to do. He goes, but the drinking, I mean, you just never knew when to stop. You always took it over the top. He goes, you keep your money and just don't drink again. And I was so surprised at how many people. I said, okay, check him off the list. The next one, I went and they said, just don't drink again, bro. I know what you did to my house. You know, I'll never get, you'll never house sit for me again. Because when he got home, the whole ceiling was full of frost. I had run the, it was 110 in Bakersfield, and I run the AC so hard that everything froze upstairs. It just, it ruined his air conditioning unit, big, beautiful house. And I just abused the trust. He goes, just don't drink again, bro. That's all. And I started serving. Not only one coffee commitment, I had two coffee commitments. I had a recording gig on Saturday nights for speakers, back when they had these little square things that had like two holes in them and there was a tape that ran through it. And you push a button, you had to push record and play at the same time. And I would sell those tapes. People would order them. And they'd buy them for a couple of bucks, and I'd go buy. And I had a big stack of blanks, and I would do that. So my time was consumed in serving and taking people to meetings. We would go to the recovery homes with meetings. We would do, we just had like a little gang of us was together, and we were staying clean together. I did a recovery home. How many people are in recovery homes here? You guys? My recovery home was the Willows. There was about 15 of us that graduated at the same time. I'm in contact with one who is still sober. And just as a warning to you guys, one of my best friends growing up, one of the guys that I drank with for first times growing up, when I went to my recovery home and I thought, this is it. I'm going away. I don't know any of these guys. He was there. And he's all like, Lorenzo, it's you. Come here. And it was the best, most comforting thing that had ever happened to me to know somebody that was there. It changed the whole perspective. I felt like, you know, I got somebody here. I can do this now. I've got somebody here. Well, he thought he had one more chance with crack. And he tried it one more time and had a massive aneurysm on his mother's couch and never came back. So I don't think we have, some of us, we don't have one more in us. That's one thing I'm afraid of, is that one more time could be the death of me. The promises are true, you guys. I read the promises before I got over here, and every one of them is true. This program has restored so much to me that I have relinquished. I gave it away because I wanted alcohol more. I wanted drugs more than my family, than my health, than anything. I've had the opportunity to work at one job for 16 years. I left that job to come here to Visalia, to start. I don't know why we're here. We're here for a good reason. Maybe we're here just for tonight. I don't know. But my driver's license that I had taken away from me with two DUIs, now I have one of the highest valued driver's licenses there is. I had the opportunity to drive around 200 kindergartners and all the way up to eighth graders every day. I'm a school bus driver. I can't believe that they let someone like me drive a school bus. If they would have known me back then, they're no. But But that's been restored to me, you guys. And speaking of all those kids, they're about the same age that my kids were when I gave up the time with them. This program and my higher power has given me the opportunity to have another chance to help, to have another chance to be around kids that age, to pour into them, to encourage them, like I should have been with my kids. This has given me another chance. It's restored that to me. And they're crazy. They cry. They scream. They fight. But you know what? It's all right, because I missed out on a lot of stuff. And now, instead of two kids, I got 200. I lost one wife, but now I've got a wife that respects my the disease that I have. She respects that I don't drink. She likes to, she used to like to drink wine and smell that, it smells oaky, or it smells like it's got a floral scent like that. And I can't understand why people, we always got past that, didn't we? Right down, give me another one. I don't buy wine by the bottle, I buy wine, the gallon or the box with ice and a straw. She didn't do that. So she doesn't drink, and she honors that that I don't drink. And she's a real good wife. She's a vice president of Goodwill Industries, and she helps a lot of people in recovery to get back and get jobs and get back into the workforce. My liver that was ruined with cirrhosis has been restored. I go back to get it checked every couple of years, and my numbers are in the normal. I try to ride my bicycle. We go on 100-mile bike rides once or twice a year. And in one day, best punishment. I've hiked Mount Whitney several times. I get out to hike as much as I can. I've got a wealth of friends that I left in Bakersfield. So my support group, I've really kind of left it behind coming over here. I know a handful of people. I'm trying to get to know some more people in the area. So, you know, if you guys want my number or something afterwards, men. So Alcoholics Anonymous, to end this, restored my relationship with God, restored my health, restored my sanity, my peace, my finances, has restored me to my family, my daughters and my son. They come and visit me now. They call me. They love me. It's restored my faith in people, because I never thought that there was a group of people who could love me when I couldn't love myself. I could not find anything to love in me, but they could. And they taught me how to love and to love others. It's restored my freedom. I no longer am bound up by fear and alcohol. So my encouragement for you tonight, you guys, get a sponsor, or at least get a phone number. Have someone that you can call. I had a bad day a couple of weeks ago, and the first person I thought about calling was sitting right over here, invited me, and I called him and I complained, and I could have been having a pity party, or it could have been just a real bad day. But as alcoholics, we can't lone ranger it. We need somebody to talk to, because if we're left, I heard the other day in a meeting here in town, the guy said, this is a bad neighborhood. And I like that. I'm going to hold on to that one. And do the steps, you guys, without fear. You don't have to do them perfectly, because you're going to do them again. I guarantee it. And finally, find some place to serve. Make coffee. We used to dump out ashtrays. I don't know if they do that anymore, because they don't smoke in the meetings anymore. Get into service. And when you serve someone else, you humble yourself, it leads to greatness, you guys. And you know what? We have an enemy named alcohol, that wants to kill us. And it likes to kill extreme people, because when we were extreme in our alcoholism, we drank extremely. When we're extreme in our recovery, we serve recovery extremely. We'll take people with us. We'll pull people out of alcoholism and into these rooms. So do it extreme, you guys. Thank you for letting me share.
Couple announcements.